The floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Harley. So I'll assume everyone has the slide deck in front of them that was posted up on your site. And so the title here is The Space Portal, Framework for Exploration and Development. And so I want to start off with giving you a little bit of background on the Space Portal. So if we go to slide two, one of the first things we did when we first founded back in 2005, we ran a national workshop entitled A New Entrepreneurial Paradigm for the International Space Station. And this was under Griffin's tenure. And I like to joke with people, we were so young and naive back then. But we had a very good turnout for this workshop. Actually, we worked a lot with Gerstenmaier. Gerstenmaier was the ISS program manager at that time. And so worked a lot with Gerst, had a very good turnout. We actually brought together for the first time users, providers, and potential funders for microgravity research. And NanoRacks actually spun out of the 2005 workshop. Another outcome of that workshop was actually the ISS National Lab, which we unveiled here at Ames in a 2007 workshop, which is also shown on that same slide. And there, Gerstenmaier actually headlined the meeting. We also had Mark Uran, who a number of you know, who came out and kind of rolled out the ISS National Lab. And I guess about a year or so later is when CASIS was selected to lead the commercial support and utilization of the ISS National Lab. So if you go to the next slide, slide three, the next thing that we did, we had a big hand in the COTS program. And actually a precursor to the COTS program was something called a Non-Traditional Approach Project Office, or NAMPO. And this was actually under O'Keefe and Steidel when this kicked off. Jeff Ballinger, actually from the NRO, led it up out of headquarters. We supported it here along with Neil Woodward, Brent Spomberg, James Bailey. And out of that Non-Traditional Approach Project Office, we came up with the idea of a metric-based program where essentially you let the companies lay out the milestones that they will achieve tied to financing, you know, rewards or payments. And then the government could use that as an evaluation criteria. And then also we got to pick or make the determination as to when someone met their milestone. And that was essentially then the basis of the COTS program, which then got handed over to JSC when Griffin came on board. And that's when Alan Lindemore and Dennis Stone and Alan Thorne and company got pulled into this. And they did an excellent job of implementing the program. We were very pleased how they essentially took the organizational model that we had laid out and adopted that and executed on it in, I think, a fantastic way. And so we're quite pleased to have helped that along. Go to the next slide, slide four. And out of COTS, I mean, there's at least two providers that were put in place because of that. SpaceX, of course, which I think we all know. But another one, of course, is the Orbital Antares, which they are looking now at getting back online after their launch failure about a year and a half ago. And on top of that, we now have Blue Origin from Jeff Bezos. And, of course, then the Vulcan upgrade out of ULA. We've had a number of discussions with Bernard Cutter and Jeff Ziegler and company down at ULA. But we now have a nice, I think, queue of really, you know, capable launch providers that have come out of the COTS program. If you go to slide five, in addition to the COTS program, and again, in my bio, it talks about my TPS background, which, again, a number of the individuals out there, including Dan Dumbacher, know about that. Yeah, I did TPS work and am a co-inventor for PICA. And PICA was actually first used on a NASA mission, the Stardust mission, which has the world record for fastest entry ever at Earth. And actually, Elon saw the Stardust mission and that result and realized that that was the heat shield that he wanted for his Dragon capsule. because he intended to go to Mars and come back from Mars. So he wanted something that had deep space return capability. And between 2008 and early 2009, I spent a good deal of time down at SpaceX doing both technology transfer of Pika to SpaceX and also helping them to set up their TPS lab, because when they started off, they literally had an empty room with light sockets and lights, and that's it. And so we had to build up an entire TPS shop. And now, you know, years later, they have, you know, one of the best, if not the best, TPS capabilities and facilities on the planet. And the picture there shows, of course, the launch of the Falcon 9 and the Dragon on orbit. And that was actually the C-1, the picture in the lower right. And again, with my fingerprints literally all over it, it was quite an exciting and, as you can imagine, with SpaceX, you know, highly, you know, energetic activity to get the whole thing in place. But it was quite exciting, and it was great to see that capsule come home, and the heat shield looks great, and Elon is very pleased. So and now they've, you know, continued to make additional improvements with Pika and actually with the with the aft heat shield, and they're doing very, very well on their vehicle. Next slide, slide six. We have a range of companies that we worked with here out of the space portal. We have quite a large commercial space network, which is shown. This includes in some major companies that you all know, Blue Origin, ULA, SpaceX, but also some other interesting companies, Google. There's a fruit company, as we like to joke about, Apple. There's startups, Deep Space Industries, Made in Space. Made in Space, actually, we served as reviewers when they were coming out of Singularity University, and actually were judges on their project. Okay. Hello? And served as judges on their project. And three young guys, and now they are doing gangbusters. They have a next step proposal with NASA for, I think, $20 million. They have a partnership with Northrop Grumman, and they have this incredible partnership with Lowe's, the home improvement company, who wants to become known, I guess, as the hardware provider for space. So they're doing quite well. We've worked with Moon Express, Scale Composites. I show NanoRacks, which came out of our 2005 workshop. And there's another company there called Spire. They're a small spacecraft company that literally spawned from the space portal here. In the summer of 2012, three ISU students came to us for an internship, summer internship. And when they walked in the door, they said that they had an idea for a space company, and would we support them in getting that going. And we told them, well, you know, I'm federal property, so you can't fundraise here. But, yes, we'd be willing to provide some consultation and so on if they could do their fundraising off-site, which they could. And so they did a Kickstarter campaign, which when they first came in and said we want to do Kickstarter, in the summer 2012, we said, what's Kickstarter? And they got done laughing, and they told us what Kickstarter was. And they started off like 2 weeks later, maybe three, they kicked off a Kickstarter campaign. They wanted to raise $30,000 in 30 days. And at the end of that 30 days, they had raised a little over $100,000. But more importantly, they had gotten 600, a little bit shy of 700 followers and supporters. And even more importantly than that, they had attracted the attention of a couple of VCs. So they quickly got set up with a several million dollar credit line up in San Francisco. And they actually pivoted a couple times on the name of their business. They started off on something called NanoSatisfy. They were looking at the education market, which is a tough market. And they are now a company. They just finished a $50 million seed round. They've launched, I believe, four spacecraft. They have facilities in four companies, and they're specializing in space and marine weather and marine tracking of shipping containers that transit the oceans. And they're doing very, very well. Let me go on to the next slide, slide seven. This is a little bit different representation of our network. We work in these three areas of supply, demand, and capital, where we're the government, the central triangle there, bringing these three different areas together. And it shows a number of the organizations that make up those different areas. And we're finding that that makes actually a very fertile mix of opportunities and kind of fertile ground to grow capabilities off of. And so we continue to pursue partnerships and activities in those areas. And we're finding this growing, you know, literally by the day, particularly recently since SpaceX made their $12 billion valuation after the investment by Google. It seems like there's somewhat of a stampede. Everyone wants to get into commercial space. We have a lot of people and entrepreneurs coming by with ideas for small spacecraft or other services. We had one company who came in just recently, who are looking at setting up a commercial PDRS, which I have, you know, folks out at Goddard might be interested in hearing that, that could actually support all these small craft, all these small spacecraft launches. So we'll see where that goes, but there's people looking at lots of different areas where they think they can provide technology and make money. Let's go to slide 8. This is a little bit of a summary of our activities, really since our inception. Up in the upper left, you see what I already mentioned, the first workshops that we ran. The lower left, back to the COTS program, but this is actually a slide view from a publication in Ad Astra that myself and Bruce Pittman published in 2013 about using the COTS model for doing lunar development, which is now getting traction in a number of areas. I show the SpaceX capsule. On the lower right, there was actually an interesting activity that that EOMD has been pursuing. It's called their Knowledge Capture Project. This is Patrick Johnson. And they actually came by and interviewed me for 2 hours. Actually, it was quite well done, and video interview. And then they took those 2 hours of interviews and cut them into 15 video vignettes that they put up on YouTube. And I actually found out that the YouTube videos were online for my kids because they had friends who were sent them messages saying, hey, there's these cool videos of this guy talking about SpaceX and space. And then they say, is this your dad? And it turns out, yes, it was their dad. And then my kids let me know, there's these really cool videos of you online. So they all said to know. Because Patrick had promised to tell me, but he was late in informing me before he put up the YouTube videos. Anyhow, but they're, I have to say from a very subjective standpoint that they're quite good, and it goes through a range of things that I both experienced and witnessed at SpaceX relative to what I've seen in my NASA career. And I think they did a very good job, and apparently Gerstenmaier is quite appreciative because he's trying to understand, again, how does NASA, you know, work in this brave new world. And so having spent a year with SpaceX, I just have some unique perspectives. So if you have a lot of time on your hand, you can go up to that COTS Knowledge Capture Project, and you'll find that whole series of vignettes. On the upper right, one of the things that we've been doing since 2012, we have what's called the Emerging Space Office that we run here out of Ames, and we produce a number of reports. We actually have a NASA research announcement that we run that's called, or it's titled, the Economic Research for Space Development. We've issued this 2 times. We're working on the third solicitation. We do this yearly. And these are small grants, typically, you know, $50K, $100K, to look at various aspects of, you know, economic research that can impact space development. And so a number of quite distributed reports have come out of this. The Emerging Space Report has gotten a lot of circulation, both at NASA headquarters and around the industry, which is quite good. Alex McDonald actually had a big hand in that. This other report, Public-Private Partnerships for Space Capability Development, likewise has gotten quite a bit of distribution. And one of the most recent startup space, this was actually done for us by the Torrey Space Group. And there they actually looked in detail what kind of investments are being made and by whom and in what amount. And one of the key takeaways that they found that there's more investment that occurred in commercial space in 2015 than did the previous 15 years. So, again, we're seeing this really strong growth pattern with regard to private investment now coming into the space industry. And, again, SpaceX has been a big part of that, of showing people that you can start with a small fortune and make a large fortune in space, at least in the case of Elon, which has been one of the perennial jokes about space. If you go to the next slide, slide 9, this shows our current development thrust that we have at the Space Portal. Let me just walk through these briefly. The first one is the commercial microgravity, and again, this goes back to our original 2005 and 2007 workshops. We've continued to work in these areas. We're finding there's a number of really exciting opportunities coming from commercial gravity. One of the latest has been something called Z-Blan, essentially exotic fibers that have dramatically lower attenuation and better bandwidth than silica. And these are materials that you, because of their zirconium is what the Z stands for, they're highly different densities, and so they are very difficult, not impossible, to produce here on the ground. And so there has been some work done in space on short flights, and now they're looking at extending this to a longer duration on the ISS. Maiden Space is actually pursuing this along with several other companies, but it could have a dramatic impact on the on our fiber optic backbone that we use for communications, and it also could have a big impact on various laser, solid-state laser capabilities. We're also running out of commercial microgravity. We're working we're leading a Centennial Challenge for a 3D vascularization challenge. This actually has to do with using space to grow 3D tissues that could be used eventually for organ patches and organ bandages. And this actually comes from a lot of biological work in space. Hello. Which has shown that there's some very big advantages from a biological standpoint, in particular, particularly for growing large macroscopic cell clusters and tissue clusters in space. And so the objective is to be able to get to the point that you can grow them large enough and actually use them for medical purposes. And there's a number of other interesting activities in microgravity as well. We work closely with CASIS and try to help identify things that that can go into their work, as well as people right out of JSC. We actually worked a deal between SGI and Intel that was picked up by Sam Shimini and then went over to JSC, where they're flying some of their advanced processors up on ISS to be able to clock the number of event interrupts that they get in a higher radiation environment, with the hope of eventually, the intent of eventually being able to develop space-qualified computers, because they see opportunity for a lot of, intelligent operations and computational capabilities in space. And they actually, there are people here joking about cloud computing on orbit. So the whole idea of having server farms in space. I mean, we'll see if that ever happens, but that's what some folks are talking about. Let me talk about the next orb, commercial lunar. This is something that we've also been watching closely. We were actually part of the Lunar Catalyst team, the source evaluation board on that. Currently, there's not a standalone business case beyond putting human remains on the moon, and so it's really out of reach at the moment, although you do have the Google Lunar X Prize, and you have people chasing that. But a lot of the companies are looking at some level of government support to kind of help lower both the technical and business barriers to doing commercial activities on the moon. Recently, ESA with their Moon Village has kind of helped this along, and there's a number of discussions in various areas about various things that could happen from a government support side to help make more commercial lunar activities go. The deep space habitat work that's being let out of AES is a good example of things that have people encouraged that maybe something can happen there. So we continue to watch that. Commercial Mars, this is actually a surprise to us. We didn't expect to see any type of serious commercial Mars activities for some time. I guess you can think about the Mars One as kind of an early, an early adopter. Some people don't see that as necessarily a serious Mars program. Maybe more of a fundraising, you know, venue. But what has really kicked us in is Red Dragon and out of SpaceX with their intent to actually put a Dragon capsule on Mars in the 2018 timeframe. I personally believe that that's quite an aggressive schedule given where SpaceX is at. I think it's most likely they'll have to roll that out to the 2021 timeframe, but they are clearly, you know, focused and interested in getting to Mars with the cooperative agreement actually led out of JSC. NASA is actually supporting Red Dragon, and so it looks like that is going to continue. So we're watching that. And then the bottom orbit commercial enabled science. This is something that we just came across recently. We're actually working with one of the heliophysicists out of SMD. It looks like there's a number of opportunities where you could leverage in-space capabilities, including some of ULA's long-duration upper stage capability that has been enabled by integrated vehicle fluids to support science missions, particularly to deep space, by doing aggregation in LEO or another convenient location and then boosting things to deep space. So that's a new area that we've started to look at. And then the center orb is planetary sustainability, and let me come back to that, but essentially it's looking at using the tool sets and developments that we make in space to essentially come back and impact planet Earth here in a useful way, particularly with regard to sustainable energy, recoverable, you know, water, you know, other aspects of planetary sustainability challenges that we see here on Earth, and with the eventual hope that you can take these technologies and use them in deep space at the Moon and Mars and beyond. And then that hence gives us the tagline there. Move on to the next slide. Slide 10. So these developments that we've been seeing raises a key question, at least in my mind and many other people's mind that I've talked with, is how is NASA coping with the rapid rise and evolution of the commercial space industry? And if you go to the next slide, this is an interesting slide, an interesting discussion that ensued from a recent NASA executive summit. And I think, Harley, you may have been on this, and Dan Dumbacher remembers these executive summits that Charlie Bolden kicked off when he came on board. And now they've gone to virtual summits, so they don't have to put out as much travel funding to get everybody together. But we had in July a NASA executive summit, and for the folks on the line, this is all the SES and STs and SLs in the agency, and which, according to Robert Lightfoot, we have 400 SES and 140 STs and SLs. So I actually didn't know the current numbers, but that's apparently it. And one of the first things they wanted to talk about in the summit was managing transition. And it was actually a former human resources person here, Linda Jensen, who led this discussion. And she was using the slide that you see there and this pictorial of yesterday's island and then tomorrow's shores. And one interesting aspect of this is that no one asked for a definition of yesterday's island or a definition of tomorrow's shore, but she was talking about the paradigm shift, the rapid change of capabilities, and how are we handling this, and saying that this is a classic managing transition scenario where you have the comfort of what you're currently doing. There is a change on the horizon. There's maybe some island in the kind of in the mist. You're not quite sure what it is, but there's these treacherous waters in between that show the alligator there. And so there was a fair amount of discussion on this. And then she actually asked, I thought, a very interesting question. She said, oh, so where do people see themselves? And she had these numbers, as you can see, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we were doing this via Adobe Connect. So you can do what's called instant polling. So she asked all the participants to weigh in, where do you see yourself? And the surprising thing is that the majority of people, at least for me, I found it surprising, put themselves in the middle of the water at position 3. That they felt that, okay, yeah, they had left yesterday's island and they were working their way to tomorrow's shores. And the next highest number actually put themselves at position 4, that they were, had made it across the water and trying to make their way up tomorrow's shores. And the fewest actually put themselves at position 1. I think 2 people, is what I recall, said they were at position 1. And I found that surprising. I thought most people would still see themselves somewhere on yesterday's island, maybe down at position 2, you know, looking at, you know, what might be possible in tomorrow's shores. But people feel that they are, I guess, making this transition from maybe more traditional, maybe Apollo-style, you know, approach versus what we're seeing now with this commercial engagement and public-private partnerships. Let's go to the next slide, slide 12. When I saw this, I had to kind of smile because the Space Portal, we were actually a group of individuals who came together because we're exploring tomorrow's shores. In fact, we like to joke we have a beach house on tomorrow's shores because we've been over there since 2005. And we understand this world quite well. Like anything, there's pros, there's cons, there's exciting opportunities, there's disappointments. It's, you know, it's not a paradise. But it does seem to be the way things seem to be transitioning when you take a look at both the funding on the NASA side, which continues to be challenging, and then you see the influx of private capital coming in on the commercial space side. That seems to be the way things are going. And so people are trying to struggle. How do they work in this new world of, you know, public-private partnerships and making space happen? So if you go to the next slide. Another key question that comes to mind then is, well, so what and where are tomorrow's shores? And that's a very valid question. And if you go to slide 14, this is actually the result of it's called the Space Pioneering National Summit that was put together back in February of 2015. And I think this probably gets as close to it as anything I've seen. And this was quite an interesting meeting. It was orchestrated by Rick Tumelson, formerly of the Space Frontier Foundation. And a number of the folks on the line probably are aware of Rick. I remember when I first came into NASA years ago, Rick was already active, and he was known informally as the bomb thrower. Okay, that he was someone that you would want to be careful about getting too close to because he, you know, might set himself on fire. But he actually had the idea for this meeting. It was actually in the summer of 2014. He approached myself and a couple of my colleagues, Bruce Pittman, and said he wanted to put together this Pioneering Space National Summit. And we said fine, that we would try to support him as we could. Well, lo and behold, when it came time for this meeting, February 20th, 2015, he had filled the house. It was actually at the Reagan Center in Washington, D.C. But it was a who's who of space there, including Gerstenmaier and a whole range of individuals. Laura Garber was there. I mean, almost all the folks that you would associate with space, Scott Pace was there, were all at this summit. And it went on for a day, a day and a half, I believe. And one of the objectives of this summit was essentially to come up with kind of an overarching rationale for the space program. And it was interesting because there were a couple things that were off bounds for discussion. One was launch vehicles. Gerstenmaier said he wouldn't come if there was going to be any discussion of launch vehicles. So that was sidelined. He couldn't talk about launch vehicles. But essentially we got to what are the end goal that we'd like to see with our space program. And so that consensus statement actually captured I think the sense of the people there, and again, it was a pretty diverse and I think well-represented group. The long-term goal of human spaceflight and exploration program in the United States is to expand permanent human presence beyond low Earth orbit into a way that will enable human settlement in a thriving space economy. This will be best achieved through public-private partnerships and international collaboration. And then it notes the participant agreed that this statement is consistent with and builds upon the 2010 NASA Authorization Act. The journey it helps the nation begin will serve many national interests and benefit the American people. And so it turns out since then there have been folks working on the legislative side, particularly I think Representative Rohrabacher and some other folks who are trying to get this now into a new authorization act. And if you go to slide 15, and this is the cover for the 2010 NASA authorization. This is the latest that we have. So it's been a while. And again, people are trying to get a updated authorization act in place that encompasses a more specific language about sustainable settlement. But even out of the 2010 act, I excerpted a couple of sections that I think that are noteworthy. One is that in the introduction, it says our goal is the capacity of people to work and learn and operate and live safely beyond the Earth for extended periods of time and ultimately in ways that are more sustainable and even indefinite, which most people that would say settlement. And then principle number two, it says the United States is committed to encouraging and facilitating the growth of the U.S. commercial space sector that supports U.S. needs, is globally competitive, and advances U.S. leadership in the generation of new markets and innovation-driven entrepreneurship. So that's a very interesting basis to build from. If you go to the next slide, slide 16, this is actually a kind of a intellectual framework that we have put together to see, okay, can we represent, the end goal of sustainable settlement in terms of where we currently are and kind of where we want to go. And so we first looked at, well, what are the key phases? If the end goal is sustainable settlement, where are we now? Well, we're doing, a lot of space exploration. But there's a middle step, which we call economic development. So we thought, okay, let's break this into these three phases. And then we looked at what are the benefits of pursuing activities in these three phases, and that's shown at the bottom of this table. So the benefit of exploration is, well, new knowledge and technologies and capabilities. Again, it's something we've been doing at NASA for quite some time. Economic development, well, that provides, a thriving space economy, which is jobs, okay, national security, precious resources, potentially planetary protection, protection from killer asteroids. And then what would sustainable settlement give you? Well, that would give you planetary sustainability, prosperous open future, and so on. So if those are the phases, if we go to the next slide, slide 17, what regions are we interested in? And we came up with these four regions that are listed there. First is what we're calling Earth Orbital Neighborhood, or EON. And this is LEO, MEO, GEO. And when we were talking to family and friends, if you talk about LEO and GEO, they get confused. If you just say Earth Orbital Neighborhood, that's a nice, compact terminology. The next area that we list is the lunar neighborhood, so the moon and its vicinity, Lagrange points, and even what's intended in here is LEOs, lunar-type orbit near-Earth objects. Then you get to the Mars neighborhood, which we're, of course, interested in. That's where a journey to Mars is leading to. And so that's both Mars and its moons. Then we have beyond. Okay, so beyond Mars, the asteroid belt, the giant planets, and so on. So if you go to the next slide, slide 18. Now with this layout, you can kind of mark on here where are we at with the different programs, both for historical context, as well as current activities. Where do they fit, both in the regions that they're addressing as well as the phasing? And historically, of course, we have some Mercury, Gemini, and Shuttle. We have the Hubble Space Telescope. We have ISS, National Lab. We have the COTS and CRS program. We have commercial crew program. We have commercial satellites. And as the commercial satellites, again, that's moving more over in the economic development side. In the same way, then, you can look in the lunar neighborhood, the Mars neighborhood, and beyond. If we go to the next slide, slide 19, this is one of the key takeaways from this, is that as you go through these phases, there's a shift in government resources and control. In the exploration phase, this is, you know, government dominated. The government funds this, the government controls what's happening in exploration, because it's something that, you know, there isn't a clear business case. And so if there's going to be advancement, the government needs to be there. Once you start moving into the economic development phase, this is a key handoff. This is where you're going from, you know, government-dominated activity to commercial-dominated activity. And commercial satellites are probably one of the best examples where this handoff has happened, and where the geocoms are, you know, largely commercial operated and funded activities. There's still the government satellites as well, but the majority are commercial. And there's other things like GLXP, and I have Red Dragon. And then if we, you know, eventually get to settlement, which we really, you know, we aren't there yet, you would envision even less government control and resources. This would have to be a self-sustaining settlement similar to what we're seeing here on planet Earth. And again, there's still government involvement for regulation and control and security, but it's a commercial activity. And what we're intending to show with this framework is that even when you're in the exploration phase, if we hope to achieve that final phase of sustainable settlement, we need to have an eye towards how do we work our way through space exploration to economic development to sustainable settlement. And that there's a time when the government is going to be controlling and funding the majority of the activity, but as things advance, there's a natural need to look for how things segue from government dominated to commercial control. And I think one of the things that we've run into that's been difficult, and ISS is probably a very good example, is handling that handoff. And because it's, if something is done purely for government purposes, it usually is not easy or even viable to try just hand it over to commercial operation. Because there's a lot of reasons why it isn't attractive for commercial operation. And so having this in mind as we, you know, plan our programs and go forward for this natural evolution from government control and resources to eventual handover to industry, I think could help in some of our planning activity and get us more, you know, get us closer to our end goal of sustainable settlement. I also think that, yeah, this is something that would play well with the public, understanding, you know, that what NASA is trying to do is open this door for sustainable settlement and, you know, better future for all our citizenry and everything else, and that's why we're spending this money, not just for technology and knowledge development, but actually leading to, you know, a better and more prosperous future. So let me go to the next slide. So this is a slide I wanted to kind of use as a tail-off point. And this is actually a quote from, many of you will have guessed, Charles Darwin, and which I think is very apropos. And this is actually something I saw Phil McAllister use in a partnership meeting that he was doing at headquarters a couple weeks ago. And that it's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent. It's the one that is most adaptable to change. And so I think the key question we have for ourselves in the aerospace industry is that how adaptable are we? And I think that as we go through this transition that I think is upon us, we will get to see the answer to that question. And so with that, I'm happy to open it up to any questions, comments.
Great. Dan, this is Harley. Thank you very much. And I'm going to exercise moderator's prerogative and ask the first question. And I will preface this by saying I suspect that the following answer will you may have to yourself preface it by saying, well, this is just my opinion, which we appreciate, not NASA policy. And that's the challenging issue of international partnership The scientific community seems to solve it, although they face their own challenges. With human spaceflight, the stated, the apparent goal for Europe is some type of fairly extensive lunar surface occupation. I don't know how deep that runs in Europe. The most recent incarnation is this lunar village.
Yeah, Moon Village. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Village. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. In the case of the Russians, they of course have always been interested in the moon, maybe more than Mars, but they have just a few months ago they announced a cutback to their human spaceflight budget.
Yeah, they're not doing well economically.
Exactly. The Chinese, who knows? But again, I think, and of course, there are political issues with respect to NASA cooperating with the Chinese, and the Indians and Japanese and so on. In any case, without getting too complicated, it does seem that that international cooperation is or international participation is an not unsolvable, but so far unsolved problem with markedly different stated goals, with NASA going to Mars unambiguously,
right.
And the most logical partner, ESA, with a relatively modest budget, much more favoring the moon. So, what are your thoughts about how to solve this particular discordancy between two otherwise natural partners, ourselves and Europe, maybe Russia?
Yeah, actually, well, let me make a couple comments on that. We've been getting lots of visits here in Silicon Valley from ESA and ESA, you know, companies and Airbus included and so on. And they're very interested in trying to copy, how we have managed to spawn space entrepreneurs that are transforming our civilian aerospace industry. And again, they don't have as much of an entrepreneurial climate and culture as we do here in the U.S. And so they've been struggling to see what can they do, because they've run into the same issue that we have, is that the government dollars are becoming tighter and tighter, and so their budgets to support the activities they want to do, like Moon Village, are becoming, you know, more harder or more difficult to secure. And so they've been looking at what could they do to leverage commercial investment. We actually had three weeks ago had a meeting at what's called the Rainbow Mansion here, which Planet Labs sprung out of, and led by actually a colleague of one of the ESA leadership. We actually even had a nice video from Eric Warner about Moon Village. But they are struggling to see what can they do to weave in the commercial element into what they're doing, and leverage commercial dollars with, you know, the scarce and scarcer government dollars. Now, as far as location, yes, they, outside of the U.S., and Elon Musk, I should say, outside of the U.S., including Elon Musk, most of the other countries, including India and even Japan, are really focused more on the moon. They see that as a near-term target for development before you try to move on to Mars. And they would love, of course, to engage in the U.S. To, you know, help develop capabilities for the moon on the way to Mars. And I think that's how they would see it, that not trying to divert NASA from going to Mars, but help make that journey more possible and more economically viable by, you know, putting resources on the moon and developing capabilities to get to the moon. And I think this is actually more of a, really a, almost a State Department and administration, you know, role to see, well, what kind of collaboration, you know, exchange of resources. As you know, with regard to international entities, we pretty much have to work on a barter system. So then it comes down to, okay, well, what can they provide and what can we provide that serves a common interest? But I think seen in that context, Harley, that, okay, again, it's what we'd call all the above, okay, that instead of, you know, it's not moon or Mars, it's that we want to develop capabilities to get to the moon, Mars, and beyond, and that our current, you know, highly focused goal is on a journey to Mars, but if there's a a more economical and viable way to get there via the moon, particularly with international support, that would be something that NASA would welcome as well. So I guess that's where I would see that playing out.
Okay, good. Do other folks, thank you, Dan. Do other folks have questions? Other questions? Okay, coming up right, not to that excellent presentation. Also, I was hoping to hear some from our summer interns, but I guess not today. Thank you very much, Dan. It was an excellent presentation, very tutorial, which is one of the styles that we particularly like on our FISO seminar. So thank you, Dan. And talk to you all in 2 weeks. I think, Dan Lester, we are not doing a FISO telecon on next Wednesday, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, good. Thank you again, Dan, and thank you all for...
Thanks, Harley. Thanks, Dan Lester.
Yeah, talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay. Bye-bye.